Coming up, tiny houses for the homeless. Lucky Severson reports on a community that formerly homeless residents run themselves. Also, renowned violinist Joshua Bell talks with correspondent Bob Faw about how music can bring a sense of divine order in the world. And the practice and meaning of Sukkot for Jews, a time of eating and praying in temporary shelters, reminding them of their ancestors who wandered in the desert for 40 years.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, U.S. health officials said they would begin screening travelers from West Africa for Ebola at five major U.S. airports. The first person diagnosed with Ebola in the U.S., Thomas Eric Duncan, died at a Dallas hospital. He'd been infected in his home country of Liberia. A vigil was held in his honor at Wilshire Baptist Church in Dallas, where his fiancée is a member. In recent weeks, faith-based humanitarian groups such as Samaritan's Purse and Catholic Relief Services have been ramping up aid to the African countries hit hardest by Ebola. In Syria, the U.S. continued airstrikes against Islamic State militants attempting to take control of the key border town of Kobani. In recent weeks, ISIS attacks have forced tens of thousands of Syrian refugees to flee to neighboring Turkey. At the Pentagon, President Obama said the U.S. mission to defeat ISIS in Syria and Iraq would be an uphill battle.
Alongside our partners, it remains a difficult mission. As I've indicated from the start, this is not something that is going to be solved overnight.
Meanwhile, a Syrian Franciscan priest, Father Hanna Jalouf, and 20 other Christians who had been kidnapped by Islamist rebels were released this week. Their captors belong to a group affiliated with Al-Qaeda called Al-Nusra. A Hindu and a Muslim known for promoting children's rights were jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize this week. 17-year-old Malala Yousafzai of Pakistan, author and advocate for the education of girls, is a Muslim. She becomes the youngest Peace Prize winner in history. 60-year-old Kailash Satyarthi of India is a Hindu activist who has fought to end child slavery in India. They will split the prize, worth just over $1 million. Here in the U.S., jubilant same-sex couples rushed to marry in Virginia after the Supreme Court cleared the way for gay marriage there and in four other states, including Utah. The court declined to review lower court decisions overturning state bans on same-sex marriage, effectively making it legal in those states. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, which has a history of battling gay marriage in Utah, said in a statement, quote, "The courts have spoken." At the Vatican, Catholic bishops opened their synod, a two-week meeting to discuss key issues affecting families. Among the topics were divorce, homosexuality, contraception, and cohabitation. Although the bishops said church doctrine cannot change, some called for greater compassion for families who don't adhere perfectly to church teaching on those issues. Several bishops also proposed simplifying the marriage annulment process for divorced Catholics. In city after city in this country, people debate how to deal with their street people, the homeless. Lucky Severson reports today on one answer. In Eugene, Oregon, the city and volunteers, among them religious leaders, have built a community of tiny houses. It's called Opportunity Village, and the residents make and enforce their own rules.
It's a gated community. It's a gated community for the homeless. It's called Opportunity Village. It's transitional housing for the homeless, and it's unlike almost any other in the country.
They're like cute little miniature houses, and I think it's something that the average person can relate to.
Andrew Heben is an urban planner recently out of college and author of a book about tent cities. He spearheaded the design of Opportunity Village and calls the miniature houses bungalows.
While it may not be much, just having a small place to call your own is a pretty important thing, no matter how small it is.
It's a heck of a lot better than sleeping under a bridge.
This is Pastor Dan Bryant, senior minister of the First Christian Church in Eugene, Oregon. He's the president of the board at Opportunity Village. He also has individual shelters for the homeless on church property and a clothing bank within the church. Pastor Bryant takes helping the disadvantaged very seriously.
If we don't, in some concrete way, help people to have a decent life here on earth, we are not fulfilling the gospel. It's that simple.
Turns out that Eugene, population about 200,000, has a high per capita rate of unsheltered homeless.
Read the Gospels. I mean, the largest, by far, topic that Jesus and the Gospels and Paul addresses are problems of the economy, of wealth and poverty. We're tired of waiting for government to fix the problem.
Pastor Bryant believes that the public should shoulder the burden to house the homeless, but that it is also a special calling for people of faith who stepped in with contributions and labor to build the village. Conventional development of low-income housing costs on average about $200,000 per unit. They're a little larger, of course, and they have indoor plumbing and electricity. But all the little houses here, all 30 of them, added together, cost less than half of one federally funded unit. And they didn't cost taxpayers a single dime.
Are these all the same size?
There's 8x8 and 8x10s.
For some people, that would be the size of a walk-in closet.
This is Laura King. She lost her job and has been living in Opportunity Village for about a year.
We've got our own bathhouse. We've got our own laundry facilities. We've got a community gathering area. The individual units don't have electricity or plumbing. And that's not like living in your own apartment. But that's okay.
Got to learn how to share food here. So we got two fridges here, 30 people.
The village has a community kitchen where residents can cook their own meals. It may be outdoors, but it's spotless.
The cost comes down to $3 a night per person. And one of those $3 is paid by the villagers themselves. They all pay $30 a month for their utilities, for the water and electricity and internet service even. So we are running this facility for $2 a head a night.
Individual units don't have electricity, but that's a small problem for people who have been sleeping in dark, shadowy places, people like Robin.
Because what I got now is I got it hooked up, my lights hooked up. So I have lights up running off of 18-volt batteries.
Those people that think that this would be a good idea, can we get a show of hands?
This is another unique aspect to Opportunity Village that organizers say was influenced by the Occupy movement.
And everyone's required to attend a village meeting, and all decisions are made in that village meeting. And so that's where everything's dealt with, and so the whole village, I mean, it's, you know, democracy at its most basic level.
There's an outside board of directors that includes faith leaders, but it's the residents themselves who make the rules and enforce them. The community doesn't take kindly to violence or too much drinking. Violators get 3 strikes, and then they're out. This is Catherine. She likes that residents have a say.
It gives you a chance to have a voice. You know, you don't feel like nobody's listening to you. You feel like you have some control over your life.
Father Brent Waz of the Episcopal Church of the Resurrection is on the village board. He also has individual shelters in his church parking lot. Father Brent tells his congregation that the message of Christ is that they should gravitate toward places of suffering, like the village.
It gives another set of lenses for us to see what God really looks like. God is not contained within the church. God is not all beautiful, you know, silver and brass and fine wine at a table at a beautiful Eucharist with an organ and all. God is alive in the world, and we need to encounter God in all the places that we encounter the world. Down at the village is another opportunity to see the face of Christ reflected back to you.
There's some well-worn faces here, but there are plenty that look like your neighbors. Tony, for instance, lost her job and then everything else. Now she's employed as a caregiver.
It's my own little place where I can regroup and get my paperwork ready and get ready for work. And we have showers here that we share and wash our clothes here, and I'm able to get to work and look clean and presentable.
Some residents are on government disability. Others have jobs.
Half of our villagers have income. They could afford a place to live if there were affordable places, but there aren't.
What you're looking at is trying to come up with first month, last month, security deposit. It's a chunk of change that's just insurmountable to where you feel defeated. You feel like there's no way that you'll ever be able to scrape together all that money all at the same time.
No one gets into Opportunity Village without first checking in. It's a refuge from a world that can be very violent, even in a university town like Eugene.
Because on the street, if you don't have a dog, if you don't have a camping buddy, then you never know if somebody's going to come at you with a crowbar.
And then when you get in here, it gives you a chance to take a breather and say, okay, so now I'm somewhere safe and I can start worrying about next week and next month and next year instead of what am I eating in a few hours because I have nothing.
Catherine and Ron Griffith moved in here after she lost her job and the roof fell in.
I kept saying it couldn't get any worse, but then it kept getting worse. I tell people at the beginning of April of last year, I had a 3-bedroom home, everything that goes with that. My 2 adult children were living with me, and I had a mother, and we thought everything was good. And by the end of May, I had none of that. It was all gone by the end of May.
But then things started to get better. She and Ron were married at Opportunity Village on Halloween by Pastor Bryant, who was dressed for the occasion.
We didn't have any music or anything, so everybody hummed the wedding march when I walked down the aisle.
Now Catherine has a job, and she and Ron live in an apartment downtown.
Coming here, and things just start falling into place, and, you know, and now we're successful members of the community. And
the village has been such a success, the city extended its lease. The next project will be called Emerald Village. There, the bungalows will be twice as big. These will be for the homeless who have a job but don't make enough to rent or own a place of their own. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Eugene, Oregon.
For many people of religious faith or with none, great music can bring with it a sense of something or someone transcendent beyond everyday experience. Correspondent Bob Faugh talked with renowned violinist Joshua Bell about his life and his music, which Bell says brings to him a sense of something greater than we are.
When you are one of the world's most acclaimed violinists, with a $3 million Stradivarius and a mastery of tone and technique that is unrivaled, when worldwide performances keep you on the road more than 200 days a year, and you still find time to record CDs, conduct and compose, as well as mentor young, aspiring musicians, along with helping raise 3 sons of your own, when you are as successful as Joshua Bell, it is perhaps not surprising that this virtuoso says the music he plays, the music he makes, reveal what he calls a sense of divine order in the world.
I mean, everyone's definition of what God means can vary, but music is something that really takes us to that sublime is a great word. That's that thing that's greater than we are, that the beauty, the magic of the universe. Bach, for instance, is probably one of the great recruiters to religion, I would think, because it's when you listen to Johann Sebastian Bach, the music, you think, you can only think that there's something great out there. There's no other explanation for the music. And for me, music has been, in a sense, my religion, and it's what brings me closest to God or to truth or whatever you want to call it.
Rehearsing here with the National Symphony Orchestra at Washington's Kennedy Center, Bell describes himself as Jewish in a cultural way, but his musical identity can best be described as universal, embracing so many composers from so many eras.
You were quoted at one point as saying, a great piece of music gives one the sense of divine order.
We live in a very chaotic world, and sometimes it just seems like a mess. You know, and one of the reasons why we listen to music, and to great classical music in particular, is that everything is in an order, in a place, and has a beauty that you see in nature, that you see that people look for when they look for God.
Bell performed recently for anyone who wanted to come at Washington's Union Station. It was 7 years ago at a metro station that he famously played Incognito, and more than 1,000 people walked by too busy to stop for or notice the beauty.
That was not a great experience for me as far as finding the connection between the audience. It didn't happen. It's funny how many ministers and rabbis and even someone from the Muslim faith told me the other day that it was used as an allegory, as an example of how we should pay attention to the beauty in the world. But it's funny how it's caught on in the religious community. I've had so many people come up to me and say, oh, my pastor talked about your story in the subway this morning.
Bell says he was influenced by the separate, diverse faiths of his parents.
My father was actually an Episcopal priest as a young man, became a psychotherapist and psychologist. My mother is Jewish, so I grew up in a mixed background. But the common denominator was certainly music, and that was sort of emphasized in my household as music being the sort of spiritual force.
A child prodigy, Bell says he's grateful for the support his parents gave him, particularly his Jewish mother, who made sure he worked hard at his art.
A lot of that has to do with the work ethic. As a child and having a very dominant, in my case, a very dominant, the stereotypical Jewish mother. But one of the stereotype is sort of true, that you need a parent to practice with your child to at a young age.
Your music is, I don't want to say it's a kind of ministry to those who hear it, but you see yourself as having a role to developing others. Why? Where did that come from?
At a certain stage in one's life, you start to think that it's time to start giving back the other direction, because you're receiving all the time. I felt I was receiving from people my whole childhood, my great teachers and patrons and people that have fostered what I'm doing. So at a certain point, you start to think, okay, it's time to start giving back. So there's no question. There's absolutely 100% confidence.
To Joshua Bell, mentoring young people is very important. He's featured here in an upcoming HBO documentary called Joshua Bell and the Young Arts Master Class. And he often works with schools, where he believes music should be a major part of the curriculum.
I think music should be the basis of an education, and everything should be sort of tied into that, because it really incorporates so many aspects of learning. Having music in their lives, it helps them learn about language, about cooperation, about beauty.
Do you have a kind of a ritual or a mindset or something you say to yourself before you step onto the stage? Whether it's a prayer or not, I mean.
My mantra, you know, before I go on stage, I have a kind of, it's a sort of meditation. Trying to get to peace with myself and focus myself, rid myself of negative, you know, thoughts, things that are really not important.
When you are performing, are you thinking about the next phrasing? Is your mind one step ahead of where your hands are?
I'm thinking ahead and trying to master my own mind, because things creep in, doubts creep in. Part of my responsibility is finding the truth inside that music, the sincerity, not looking for gimmicks, and looking inside myself and finding what I experience as the truth in the music.
46, no longer the wonderkin, Joshua Bell says he will never stop performing because for him, music provides endless opportunity and challenge.
It's inevitable that physically there are things that will start to decline, get a little bit slower, a little rustier. The nice thing about music is that you can keep growing in an artistic way throughout your life.
And there's something more, says Joshua Bell. A gift like his, he concedes, confers a solemn responsibility.
I guess there's a certain obligation that that when you are given a gift, and I think of it that way, that I've been given this gift of not just the ability and the capacity, but also the gift of everything around in my life. There's more to life than whether I make a mistake on stage or not. The music is about a sort of magical experience, and I also just think about how lucky I am to be doing what I'm doing, to help bring beauty to people.
Joshua Bell then at the pinnacle, still reaching, still learning, and ever mindful that music like this is a pathway to something greater. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Fall in Washington, D.C.
Finally, on our calendar, Jews celebrate Sukkot through next Wednesday. It's a time for eating and worshiping in temporary shelters, reminding Jews of their ancestors' 40 years of wandering in the desert after their escape from slavery in Egypt. We spoke with Rabbi James Michaels of the Hebrew Home of Greater Washington about sukkahs used during Sukkot.
The book of Leviticus tells us that we should remember that God allowed us to live in temporary shelters, the sukkah, when we lived in the desert for 40 years. We lived in booths, knowing that we were going to move from place to place, not necessarily every day, but certainly from one year to the next, we lived in different areas. The sukkah that we build every year is to remind us of that experience. The basic requirement is that the roof must be artificial and have more shade than light, but must be open to the elements. The walls can be made out of anything. As you can see in the background, mine are made of canvas, and these are very popular. There's all sorts of decorations. Some plastic fruit. Some people will put up real fruit and vegetables up there. People will put even Christmas lights in it. When my wife was growing up, she would take all the holiday cards that they received for the new year, and they would cut out the pictures and hang them up on their sukkah. I've heard of people sleeping in the sukkah. It's not really required, but there are some people who do it. The important thing is the eating and the sharing of meals, because that is the basic activity that we do in our home. One of the things that we do on Sukkot is take what we call the four species, the Arba Minim, which is a palm branch, sprigs of willow, sprigs of myrtle, and a citron, which looks like a large lemon.
Praised are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe.
We hold all four of those and we wave them, and we smell them and we hear them. So that experience is something that really gives us a very nice feeling of being alive, of being in touch with our senses. 5 days ago, on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, we denied ourselves any sensory experiences. Everything was thinking, sitting, and praying. Sukkot is just the opposite. It's an indulging of the senses. Every one of our senses is indulged when we sit in the sukkah and enjoy the atmosphere, the food, hear the sounds of the city, hear the sounds of the countryside if we're living out in a rural area. People think that religion is only one aspect of life. No, it involves everything. There's just as much for physical and sensory experiences as there is for contemplation and meditation.
Following Sukkot is Simchat Torah, which celebrates the end of the annual cycle of Torah readings and starting all over again. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more and where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Christian band Hillsong United, which won 5 Gospel Music Association Dove Awards this week, including Song of the Year. The song is called Oceans. Wherever you call me, take me deeper than my feet could ever wander, and my faith will be made stronger in the presence of my Savior.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics Newsweekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.